The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Rivka Skidmore from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Flavor is about helping you live a healthier, happier lifestyle. A recipe for mini fruit tarts makes 15 tarts, takes about an hour and 10 minutes. You'll need 1 pound of plums or apples or pears and cut into 1/2-inch slices. You'll need 1 pound of raspberries or blueberries or half strawberries, 4 refrigerated rolled pie crusts, 1/4 cup of sugar, 1/4 cup of apricot jam, and 2 tablespoons of lemon juice. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Line 2 large baking sheets with parchment paper. And for each tart, toss 1/4 cup of sliced plums and 1/4 cup of raspberries with 1/2 teaspoon of sugar. Let sit, tossing occasionally for at least 10 minutes. Meanwhile, roll each pie crust into a 12-inch circle. Using a small bowl, about 5.5 inches wide as a guide, cut 3 circles from each crust. Place the circles on prepared baking sheets and divide fruit among your circles, leaving a 1-inch border. Fold the exposed dough up over the fruit, crimping or pinching it at several points to preserve a round shape. Lightly brush the crusts with water and sprinkle each with 1/2 teaspoon of sugar. Bake until the fruit is bubbling and tender and the crust is golden brown, about 20 to 25 minutes, and then let cool for 10 minutes. Meanwhile, in a small bowl, whisk together the jam and the lemon juice and gently brush over the fruit while the tarts are still warm. Serve warm or at room temperature. You are listening to Flavor on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A little help from your friends. Ashley Kostewick was nursing her infant son when she felt it, a tiny hard mass in her right breast. The 31-year-old mom of 2 tried to convince herself it was just a clogged milk duct, but 2 months later, the lump had grown and a biopsy confirmed her worst fear. She had breast cancer. First came distress and dismay, and then months of chemotherapy, 3 hours round trip every 3 weeks, and a double mastectomy and a breast reconstruction, and then bills and bills and more bills. Kostewick was shocked by the cost of her treatment, especially because she had good insurance, and as she faced additional surgeries and radiation, she didn't know her family would pay for it. When her Aunt Patty set up a fundraiser on GoFundMe, almost immediately, people, and not just friends and relatives, started pledging to help Ashley fight cancer. Her aunt has since raised more than $14,000 that her niece has been able to put towards travel expenses and the insurance plan's annual $5,500 out-of-pocket maximum, letting the family breathe easier. For years, crowdfunding, raising money from family, friends, and even strangers through social media, has been a grassroots way to launch projects or products, but now, sites like GoFundMe, YouCaring, Generosity by Indiegogo, campaigns to cover medical expenses are dominant categories. In a 2016 survey, one in five working-age Americans with health insurance reported difficulty paying their medical bills. Medical debt is already the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in the U.S., as uncertainty around the future of the Affordable Care Act drives up many premiums and out-of-pocket costs continue to rise. Even more people will likely face health-related financial crises. While crowdfunding sites are no substitute for comprehensive health insurance, they offer a modern version of charity potluck dinners with a broader reach. Campaigns can help sick or injured people hold on to their home, retirement savings, even their life. They also give friends and family a chance to lend a hand. And here's what tends to work best. Keep it real. To estimate how much money you'll need, start by considering out-of-pocket insurance maximums, says Lauren Fisher of the nonprofit crowdfunding site Redbasket. Then add uncovered bills like visits to specialists, as well as transportation, lodging, and lost wages. Start with a conservative goal, says Jennifer Kim, a doctoral student at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who has studied medical crowdfunding. That's what the writer and comedian Akilah Hughes did in 2016 when she needed surgery to remove benign liver tumors that were making her ill. She asked for $10,000 on GoFundMe and gradually increased her target until she raised nearly $40,000, covering 60% of her costs. Getting personal. Effective campaigns are detailed and personally compelling, says Rob Solomon, CEO of GoFundMe. Write a thorough description of the recipient's health status with an explanation of how the money will be spent. Update your supporters regularly. Use a specific title like Monica's Medical Fund Against Lyme instead of a vague Please Donate. Include a recent snapshot or video of the patient so donors feel a connection. Spread the word. The key to crowdfunding is your crowd. Appeals by email in which people send contacts a campaign link tend to be the top source of contributions on Indiegogo, while GoFundMe reports that Facebook posts boost donation rates by 350%. Organizers can expect a third of a goal to come from friends and relatives, a second third from acquaintances, and a final third from networks of strangers, some of whom may have had something in common with the recipient, says Brianna Diagamarino, Senior Director of Social Innovation at Indiegogo. For example, the campaign for Kostyuk generated $900 in a single hour after a breastfeeding support group shared a photo of her nursing her son the last time before chemo. It was just a miracle. The right people saw it. You are listening to Flavor on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Healthier chocolate cake with a secret. A sugar-free, healthy chocolate cake made from black beans at healthyindulgences.net. Chocolate cake made without flour, sugar, or dairy. Low-carb and gluten-free, of course. Cake made out of a surprise ingredient that'll make you wrinkle your nose upon hearing it. This cake is good. So good, in fact, I had to stop to have a mug of stevia-sweetened pomegranate tea and go to bed so I'd stop shaving off test slices. You know those feelings that come over you when you play around a bit with a recipe, adding a pinch of this, a tablespoon of that? The nervousness as you check the batter in the oven and fiddle with the baking time and check and recheck for doneness, and the anticipation as you're cutting the cake and hoping upon hope it's not too dry or too mushy or too crumbly. It's always a roller coaster of emotion. This time, a very sweet ending. Why was this particular culinary journey so nerve-wracking? Because it's made from black beans. Beans. Seriously. Even if you're the fiercest of bean haters, like I am, you'll fall head over heels for moist chocolate cake. I haven't had a flour and sugar-based chocolate cake in a very long time, so my roommates had to confirm this cake's rock star status. Safe to say they agreed with me, and they hungrily polished off the slices I provided for them. Served with a cold glass of almond milk. It was all more refreshing the day after spent soaking up the Carolina sun. Note: I cut one single layer in half widthwise and stacked the semicircular halves on top of each other to achieve a two-layer cake. Just double the recipe to make a whole two-layer cake. The frosting gets rich dark coloring from Hershey's Special Dark Cocoa Powder. The best part about this cake is that it's totally budget-friendly. It's basically beans, eggs, and cocoa. That gives you no excuse not to try it. You hear? This gluten-free chocolate cake is so decadent and moist, you'll never guess its secret ingredient, black beans. The key to making sugar-free cake taste so good is to use a blend of sugar-free sweeteners, stevia, Splenda, Truvia, erythritol, etc. You can also use honey in place of the sugar-free sweeteners if you like. Just make sure that the batter is sweet enough before you bake it. You'll need 1 15-ounce can of black beans, or 15 ounces of cooked, unseasoned black beans, 6 large eggs, 1 tablespoon of pure vanilla extract, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 6 tablespoons of unsalted organic butter, or 5 1/2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 1/2 cup plus 2 tablespoons of honey or Truvia, 6 tablespoons of unsweetened cocoa powder, and 2 teaspoons of baking powder. Preheat the oven to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Spray a 9-inch cake pan with extra virgin olive oil cooking spray, or grease it with a thin layer of butter. Dust cocoa all over the inside of the pan, tapping to evenly distribute. Cut a round of parchment paper and line the bottom of the pan, and then grease the parchment lightly. Alternatively, you can make cupcakes. If you'd like to bake the batter as cupcakes, line 16 cupcake tins with paper liners. Drain and rinse the beans in a strainer or colander, and shake off excess water. Place beans, 3 of the eggs, vanilla, and stevia if you're using, and salt into the blender, and blend on high until the beans are completely liquefied. No lumps. Whisk together cocoa powder and baking powder, and in a bowl, use a mixer to cream the butter with sweetener, erythritol, or honey until light and fluffy. Mix in the 2 remaining eggs, beating for a minute after each addition, and beat the bean mixture into the rest of the batter. Finally, stir in the cocoa powder and water if you're using, and beat the batter on high for 1 minute until smooth. Scrape the batter into a pan and smooth the top. Grip the pan firmly by the edges and wrap it on the counter a few times to pop any air bubbles. If you're baking the cake as a single round layer, bake for 40 to 45 minutes. If you are baking the batter as cupcakes, bake for 35 minutes. The cake is done when the top springs back when you press on it. Remove the cake to a cooling rack to cool for 10 minutes. Turn out the cake from the pan and flip over again onto the cooling rack. Let the cake cool until it reaches room temperature, and then cover in plastic wrap. For best flavor, let the cake sit overnight. If you're stacking this cake, level the top with a long serrated knife, shaving off the layers until the cake is round and flat and even. Store cake or cupcakes in the refrigerator, and for best flavor and texture, warm the cake to room temperature before serving. You are listening to Flavor on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Is it still possible to live simply in today's world? From Little House Living by Marissa. We recently got back home from a quick overnight trip to the big city, and big city to me means more than 1,300 people. During our time there, I can't even count how many times I remarked something along the lines of, "People move so quickly. Why are they getting upset over that? Can't they see it's just stuff?" I stopped at a few thrift stores and a few big box stores and watched as some left with carts loaded sky high. Of course, I don't know these people's situation. Maybe they had a whole house to fill. Maybe they were buying it for someone else. It's not for me to judge, but it did get my mind working. There's no doubt we live in an age of materialism. This prompted me to think about some things on our 4-hour drive home. Is the simple life we're striving to live actually possible in today's world? First, we have to define what we mean by simple living. That's not as easy as it sounds, since simple living will mean something different to everyone, depending on where you live and what stage of life you are in. My definition of simple living is this: to live self-sufficiently, naturally, minimalistically, and joyfully. So let's think about these things for a while. Is living self-sufficiently possible in today's world? I think it is, but to an extent. I have no desire to learn to make my own shoes or my own fabric for clothing. I think that some things aren't really a great idea anyway, since they end up costing you more money than they're worth. I'd rather stockpile things like that if needed. Self-sufficiently is something else to us. It means to be as self-sufficient as possible. For my family, personally, that means to grow as much of our own food as possible, to raise our own meat, to have simple skills for everyday things, which mean we depend less on the outside assistance. Self-sufficiency will look different to everyone, depending on where you live and resources you have available. You may need to be more self-sufficient in some areas than others. It's very possible to live quite self-sufficiently in today's world, as long as you teach yourself the skills you need. You might want to check out an article on ways anyone can be self-sufficient. Is living naturally possible in today's world? We happen to live in a world that is filled with more chemicals, preservatives, and unwanted, unnecessary things than ever. Crops are genetically modified, and animals are stuffed with things to make them produce more, and artificial ingredients are added to everything we eat, wear, and use. Fortunately, we also live in an age where the knowledge is abundant. There is more and more research being done every day about these ingredients to help us make informed decisions. Of course, not mainstream media, but when is that ever accurate? Thanks to this info, we can choose untainted seeds to plant. We can try and purchase clothing and fabric made from natural fibers. We can create our own simple health and body products that don't need preservatives and chemicals to help them work. Nothing's going to be perfect, but just because nothing can be perfect doesn't mean we can't try for the best possible. Is living minimalistically possible in today's world? While researching this article, I looked up the word minimalistically in the dictionary, and here's what I found. Minimal. Well, that's a bit depressing. Materialistically is in the dictionary, but the word above is not. What does that say about today's world? Fortunately, it doesn't have to be the case if you don't want it to be. We started getting rid of about 50% of our things when we moved in a camper, and then a few months later we had another sale and sold 50% of what we had left. And now, moving into a house, I'm getting rid of a bunch more. It's much easier to get minimalistic lifestyle if you take it slow and you don't feel like you're missing something. And trust me, the more you get rid of, the more you want to keep cleaning out. Our goal is to only have things we really need and use at least once a week, or things we can't replace, like memory items. That's all we're keeping. Is living joyfully possible in today's world? With all the death and destruction in today's world, it is possible to still live a joyful life? Absolutely! It doesn't mean that we simply ignore the things that happen around us, but taking some of it out of the picture will help. Remember when I stopped using personal Facebook at the beginning of the year to find other ways to communicate with my loved ones? That was my favorite goal I kept this year. I've distanced myself from unnecessary gossip and drama, and I'm connecting deeper with ones I really care about. It's been a truly great experience so far, and I hope to write more about it. My point is, we don't have to go completely Amish, but cutting out drama and worldliness in our lives, we can help reduce stress and help us live more joyfully. I also believe that all the above will help lead a more joyful life as well. So is living simple actually possible? I believe it is, but it's not going to be easy. And no simple life is ever going to be perfect, but it is possible, even in the world we are in today. Waste not things you can guiltlessly ditch. Birthday parties for adults. If they're over 18 and not turning an age that ends in zero, you are off the hook. Hosting every single sleepover. Your kids' friends have homes. Don't let yours become a hostel. Kitchen grunt work. Shortcuts do not a lazy cook make, says Julia Tertian, author of the cookbooks Small Victories and Feed the Resistance. Saved time is saved sanity. I used pre-peeled garlic, shrink-wrapped cooked beets, and frozen peas. I'd much rather pick up takeout than dirty another pot. Lackluster books. If you're 50 pages in and not in love, stop. Of the world's 129 million plus books, one has got to be a better fit. Balking at the idea? Let the Library of Congress, Carla Hayden, reassure you. I own many books I didn't read to completion, and that is okay. Amen. You are listening to Flavor on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Secrets of the World's Healthiest Eaters. These tips and tricks make it easy to follow the Mediterranean diet. In the late 1950s, American physiologist Ansel Keys was conducting research in southern Italy and Greece when he made a surprising discovery. The people who lived in countries that bordered the Mediterranean Sea seemed healthier than any other populations he'd studied around the globe. In fact, they enjoyed some of the longest lives and lowest heart disease rates in the world. Keys could have attributed the benefits to the abundant sunshine or invigorating salt water, but what if, he wondered, the result was the food? The people in this region had diets focused on fruits and vegetables, whole grains and beans, and they used olive oil, plenty of it, as their primary fat. They flavored their food with herbs and spices instead of salt. They ate very little meat and few refined carbohydrates and processed foods. Since then, Keys' theories have been proved. An ever-growing body of evidence shows the Mediterranean style of eating is one of the most effective ways to maintain a healthy weight, feel great, and live a long, vigorous life. In fact, a 5-year study of nearly 8,000 adults concluded that following a Mediterranean diet could reduce the risk of heart disease by up to 30%. Adopting this approach to eating is a matter of shifting many foods you already enjoy. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, healthy fats, and seafood to the center of your plate. And as you eat more of these foods, you'll naturally have less room for the unhealthy ones. You are listening to Flavor on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Here are 12 steps you can take to give your diet a Mediterranean makeover. Number 1. Go with the seasonal flow. Instead of trying to create a meal plate out of thin air, let the seasons be your guide. If the market is overflowing with fresh carrots or parsnips, for instance, there's a good bet they're at their peak of deliciousness, so build your meals around those ingredients. Start with a pile of greens. In many parts of the Mediterranean region, a meal is not complete without a heaping mound of lettuce, spinach, kale, Swiss chard, or dandelion greens. Rethink your usual mealtime ratios by having a large green salad and a small portion of protein, rather than the reverse. Or use raw or cooked greens as a bed for fish or chicken or pasta or even rice. Make a meal out of your sides. Take a cue from Spanish-style tapas or Middle Eastern meziplats. Create a meal from several veggie-centric appetizer-style dishes like roasted cauliflower or tomato cheese kebabs. You'll be surprised at how satisfying a selection of small plates can be. Cook your whole grains on Sundays. Preparing a big batch of whole grains ahead of time makes it easy to add them to your recipes all week long. Try stirring brown rice into soups or adding bulgur to your favorite meatball recipe. You can also fold cooked grains into muffin batter or even add texture. Treat meat as a flavor enhancer. Try tossing a little shredded chicken and turkey into a grain and vegetable pilaf. Find new uses for bread. When you eat Mediterranean, bread isn't just for sandwiches. Toss crunchy toasted whole grain bread into a salad as an alternative to ripe croutons. Swap sweet yogurt or cheese for savory. Yogurt and cottage cheese are always tasty with fruit, but they're wonderful in savory dishes too. A dollop of cool tangy yogurt is an ideal contrast for vegetables like warm, earthy beets. Bake with whole grain flours. Whole wheat flour is a great option, but cornmeal, rye flour, and buckwheat are equally delicious. Check your condiments. Many store-bought varieties of mayonnaise are made with soybean or low-quality oils. Opt for a brand made with extra virgin olive oil instead. Think simple for snacks. This means sticking with foods in their most natural form, like fresh fruits or vegetables or nuts or seeds, rather than highly processed foods. Give your food a flavorful finish. Mediterranean eaters drizzle olive oil on their food all the time. It's a final flourish that adds extra flavor and richness to their dishes. End meals with fruit. For everyday meals, most Mediterranean eaters enjoy fruit for dessert. Have what's in season. Berries in the spring and summer, pear or figs in the fall, and clementines and pomegranates in the winter. And make it special by serving it on a pretty platter.
Run out of time for today's episode of Flavor. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Rivka Skidmore, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Flavor is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long, until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to Flavor.